This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, maybe it's someplace like Thief River Falls, Minnesota, no matter how big or small it is, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who, when you take the time to talk to them, you're going to learn have done some incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And each week we hear those stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired. And I think that'll be the case today with 94-year-old Gordon Caldas. He lives in Fresno, California now at the beautiful Veterans Home of California. Had a chance to tour it. Thanks to Ray Lazar for inviting me out here and getting just a little taste of what many more veterans are going to experience for many years to come. And where else would you go to find the captain of the 1941 University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux football team? You have to come here to the Veterans Home, and that is one distinction Gordon has. But let's go back earlier than that, Gordon, to your childhood growing up in Minnesota in Thief River Falls. What kind of town was that?
It's a farm community, basically. About 4,500 people went through high school there, and I participated in athletics. Then upon graduation, I was recruited to University of North Dakota, which was just 50 miles away in Grand Forks. University of North Dakota is around 15,000 students. I got a Bachelor of Arts degree in commerce, business. My senior year, while Pearl Harbor occurred, then my draft number was immediately drawn, but I had a chance then to graduate.
You mentioned Pearl Harbor. I want to ask you about that. That's a question I ask every veteran on the program because everyone remembers something. And I know it's hard because that was so long ago, but I try to understand how big a deal it must have been at the time, because here you are in your senior year of playing football. You guys probably just finished your football season in early December. I'm sure you had all kinds of things on your mind about what you wanted to do when you got done at the University of North Dakota.
Yes. Well, I was concerned about getting a chance to graduate because I thought possibly, you know, they might draft me because my number was drawn right away. So anyway, I started talking to recruiters, and I ran into the Navy, who said that they were creating midshipman schools at a couple of the universities, Columbia University and Northwestern. They needed a lot of Navy officers. Columbia University is where I was ticketed to go. A good friend of mine and I, Jim Idy, we went out to Seattle and got jobs in shipyards. We worked there until midshipman school called for both of us.
Sorry for rewinding here and backtracking on you, but there are a few things that happened while you're in Grand Forks that were pretty significant, I guess. And with December 7th specifically, do you remember how you heard that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and what it meant to you as a young man at the time of, what, 21 years old?
You know, in those days, there were no scholarships. What they gave us in those days was a job, a part-time job, and usually $15 a month, paid by the hour, 25 cents. Anyway, I worked in the laundry, and then I waited tables at the Gamma Phi Beta House sorority.
So you were doing one of those jobs on December 7th?
Yes. I was in my room. Incidentally, the athletes had rooms in the stadium, and those were our rooms. We got those free. The first thing I heard, I was in my room in the stadium, and the president came on the air, radio, and entered his declaration of war against Japan. That was my introduction then, and almost immediately, my draft number came up.
Yeah, I could see how that would stick with you. As far as playing football, and I know you played halfback and defensive back. In those days, it was everybody playing both ways if you were good enough. Was there one particular moment or one particular game that was kind of the highlight of your North Dakota football career?
Yes, I was a co-captain. The other halfback and myself, Walt Dober, who went on to play pro ball. I played both ways, so I played a lot of football, and I was fortunate in that I never got injured in the 2 years that I played regular. I did manage to score a fair amount, and I also like to play defense.
I know you guys even scrimmaged the Canadian Football League team from north of there in Winnipeg, but as far as your big rival, I'm guessing it had to be North Dakota State, right? Was that a pretty big deal when you met up with the Bison?
Yes, it was. They were the big opponents, and North Dakota State had good teams. But when we were at school, why, we dominated North Dakota State.
I'm sure your grandkids and great-grandkids are going to hear this, and they turn on the TV now, and they see football, and it's pretty different from the football you played. You just mentioned no injuries, but people should understand. You guys had very little padding. You had no face masks. How big a difference was the game you see on TV today compared to what you played in the 1940s?
The teams are better. The squads are larger. The players are bigger. You have to credit them. When I watch college games now, they're much faster, and it's better football.
No nostalgia there. And one more question on that. You know, for many years, North Dakota and North Dakota State have not played each other, and the schools have agreed to renew that rivalry starting next year. What does that mean to someone like you who played in that rivalry, you know, nearly three quarters of a century ago?
Playing the North Dakota State was the biggest game of the season every year. I think we beat the Bison all 3 years. They were the big competition and the most spirit among the students and the players.
And in the span of, I guess, about a year and a half, you'd go from your biggest opponent being the North Dakota State Bison to being Imperial Japan, and it was no laughing matter. But there was another thing that happened in Grand Forks that I think was pretty significant. You ended up marrying the homecoming queen at the University of North Dakota. How'd you pull that off?
Very fortunate. She was not only a beautiful girl, but a super girl, and we had five great children. She wanted seven, but she had two miscarriages, and so we ended up with five children, three girls and two boys.
How did you two meet?
I was a Phi Delta, Phi Delta Theta. Between sororities and fraternities in those days, Monday night was meeting nights. After the Monday night meetings in the individual fraternities and sororities, they'd have a dance for about an hour. And it was one of those dances at the Gamma Phi House that I met my future wife.
And you've already filled us in that, you know, after Pearl Harbor and after the draft notice, you enlisted in the Navy, you're off at midshipman school at Columbia, you're thinking, I'm going to get involved in this war at all. Did that leave you a dilemma as far as what to do about Lenore and what you're going to do with that relationship?
After I volunteered for PT boats, I started hearing about PT boats and their operations, and it dawned on me that there was considerable danger.
Then why'd you volunteer for it? What were you thinking?
I hadn't thought about it previous.
So once you figured it out, you said, what did I get myself into, huh?
I really did seriously think then. I broached that to her, that because of the danger that I understood was likely there, perhaps we should wait until after the war and then get married. Shortly after that, I got a call from my wife, wife-to-be. Her girlfriend was on the phone. She said, you know, I understand that you're hesitating to get married. I'd like to tell you that she's had at least four proposals of marriage. So you're in danger unless you do marry her. So then I immediately called her, and we talked some more, and we decided to get married as soon as I graduated from Columbia University Midshipman School. And then I went back to Grand Forks, and we were married in Grand Forks.
How hard was that to head overseas knowing here's a young bride that she doesn't know if you're going to come back to see her again or not? Was that hard, or was it a plus that now you had something to come back for?
Well, I think the fact that we were then married, and I was certainly happy that I had married her, because, of course, to me, she was a super, and as it turned out, made a beautiful wife and mother, and so we had a good life.
But you had quite a bit to survive to be able to enjoy that life. And you talked about learning about PT boats. Maybe people are familiar with President Kennedy and PT 109, or maybe they've seen that old John Wayne film, They Were Expendable, and they think that's what it was all about. Maybe they've been to Fall River and seen the museum with the PT boats there. But for folks who maybe aren't that familiar, describe a PT boat for us. What's it like to be on board one, to operate one? How do you describe that to someone who really doesn't get it or hasn't experienced it?
PT boats are close combat. They're small boats, they're fast, with aircraft, enemy aircraft, in literally dozens and dozens and hundreds. When we arrived at in the Philippines and in Borneo, we realized that it was tough duty.
And these boats, you say small, and it's all relative. You know, someone might get on a PT boat and say, boy, this is 80 feet long, and there's, you know, 50-plus tons of stuff on here, and they think it's big. But that puts it in perspective a little bit. What about the armament that you guys had at your disposal on your PT boat?
PT boats, when we got them in Brooklyn Navy Yard, they just had a 20-millimeter on the bow. They had two turrets of twin 50-caliber machine guns, and they had a 40-millimeter on the stern. When our squadron was organized, the squadron commander appointed me as assistant armament. So I got to thinking, as we traveled south to Australia, in my view, we needed more armament. I commenced making plans and drawings as to what would fit additionally aboard the boats, because we understood that by the time that we would arrive there, things would change. And of course, the Japanese had already moved into New Guinea and all of the islands, taking over the Philippines and Borneo and so on, that more armament was in order. When we got to New Guinea, we started stopping off and on at U.S. Army camps, which were going full steam at that time against the Japanese. So we bummed additionally 20 millimeters. We also got anti-tank guns from the Army. As a consequence, well, we got to be gunboats, because our situation changed. We were not running into big ship Navy to the extent that they were in the beginning. By the time that we arrived and in the Battle of Leyte, the Japanese had changed their tactics, and instead of combat planes with the U.S., they were commencing suicide attacks. We couldn't believe it. In the first instances, when we watched the Japanese take their planes right straight in and crash them right into the different ships rather than just using machine guns.
Yeah, I imagine that was a pretty big eye-opener. That why would anyone even consider that before? And then you're seeing it in front of your eyes. And did that change the way you guys operated from that point on?
Yes. We converted primarily so as to be able to stop reinforcements. We made night patrols. For example, in Leyte, we patrolled from dusk to dawn on the west side of Leyte Island while our troops were proceeding from the east coast. And our job was to travel up and down the west side to intercept any and all reinforcements, personnel, supplies, that type of thing.
And you'd see some pretty historic things later on at Leyte, and that has to do with a famous name from World War II. We're going to get to that. But in just reading some of your memoirs, I saw a lot of things of note. Battles where you guys were shooting down enemy planes, where you're taking out enemy ships, where you're dropping off American troops who were going to liberate prisoners. I mean, there's quite a few different twists and turns. Do you remember this as kind of an exciting time in your life, a nerve-wracking time, a frightening time? What do you remember about those years you spent out in the Pacific?
You seem to kind of stabilize. You get used to battle. It's not constant battle. There's lots of slow times. But when we arrived over there, the temperament changed. You became more used to it, as I would say. From time to time, you would see examples. I can remember in one of our combats, one of our crewmen went to pieces.
Well, and I want to gain an understanding of the kind of situations that could produce that kind of reaction, the situations you survived in World War II. I know those 14 grandkids of yours and four great-grandkids are pretty thankful that you did. Gordon Caldas is our guest today, 94 years young. We're going to dive into his adventures as a PT boat commander when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Gordon Caldas, 94 years old. He lives now at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, but he grew up in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, where he helped the Prowlers of Thief River Falls High School to a Hoosiers-like basketball season in 1938. Undefeated, 27-0, state champions with a nail-biter of a 31-29 victory over the Big City Boys from Minneapolis North. See if you can spot Gordon in the photo of that championship team that I have up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or in his story at hometownheroesradio.com. The team that he was on in World War II was called the U.S. Navy, and as a PT boat commander in the Pacific, PT 522 to be exact, he carried a good deal of responsibility. Before the break, Gordon shared that he got used to combat, but can you give us some examples of those moments that you can never really get used to, where you had to react in an instant and do something that might make the difference between life and death?
One of the first patrols in Leyte, we had to travel from the east side of Leyte all the way down to the end of the island and go around the island and then back up on the west side of Leyte Island. What our commanders did, the plan was two boats together and up the whole entire west coast of Leyte. They stationed two boats in intervals of 2 or 3 miles apart the entire length of Leyte Island, and you were in that zone. Your job was to travel along at slow speed along the coast, close in, and cover those several miles. And then there was another zone of PT boats and so on the whole length. And we patrolled at idling speed that whole night in anticipating reinforcements that were coming in with the Japanese in a whole row of barges filled with personnel and, of course, ammunition and supplies. But there could be 5, 6, 7, 8 big barges with our radar, which, of course, was a saving grace for us. It shows a number of pips, small pips. These are vessels, and of course those rays bounce back, and they show on the screen, and they show you a pip that relates to the size of the vessel. We would pick those up. The radar man was down below in the cockpit calling to me and to the executive officer who was on the wheel. As the commander, I have a microphone in my left hand, microphone in my right hand. The one on the left microphone is to my crew. In my microphone in my right hand, that microphone is a second boat. So you're in command of both boats. My order to the second boat is to be close to our rear. We'll take a swing all the way around to the head of the Japanese barges. When you get to the head of it, take a left and proceed along the whole line of barges with your broadside and close together. And when you hit the head barge, give the orders to fire at will. So both boats with their broadsides would proceed slowly along that whole row of barges and demolish just as many as we can. They were packed with personnel and supplies, and our job was to destroy them all.
And that's one thing, but there were people out there that wanted to destroy you, too. And the sense I've gotten from talking to PT boat crewmen over the years is that there aren't necessarily a whole lot of places to hide on a PT boat if the enemy is shooting at you.
One thing that you kind of grin at, you know, the PT boats were made of plywood and two layers of plywood. So there's no protection. And I didn't mention that, but when you hit the head of the barge traffic, the personnel within those barges are firing at you. Fortunately, they're mostly rifles. The Japanese soldiers had rifles. And of course, with our armament, when you consider the broadside power that those two boats had, was really something. One thing that I used to have to do is always watch after I gave the order to fire at will, is when the enemy starts shooting at you, you have a tendency to duck sometimes. You'd see our guns going up in the air. I'd have to yell, you know, lower your barrels, and they'd come right down and get on target. Most of the time, we'd demolish them. I can recall another instance where we had a surprise. This was a later combat. We discovered on the radar, we're hitting a long line of barges, but then there were three larger boats about the size of our PT boats, and they were surrounding and protecting the barges. So we were alerted that obviously they had some protection. When we came around to the head of the procession and straightened out, well, here was what we later found out were three Japanese PT boats, and one was at the head. When I gave the order to fire, our two boats blew that PT boat right out. We nailed that PT boat and then started demolishing all of the barges. There were the two PT boats towards the end, and then, of course, when we got to that point, we hit the second PT boat, and it took off. It started running. We chased that second PT boat. I'm confident it did not have radar. We had radar, and of course, our radar was ran on it, and so we chased it, ran it down, and sunk it. So we got two out of the three PT boats, and I think virtually all of the barges. We think those were the only Jap PT boats that any of us ran into. Another instance, there were four boats at dawn, two sets of PT boats. We joined together down at the southernmost point. We went around the island, and at dawn, we pulled up in close to the shore, had deep water, to wait for our air cover. Because suicide planes at that point in the Battle of Leyte, the Japanese were really shooting their wad. Things weren't going well with them, and they converted to the suicide planes rather than the fighters. Same planes, but from a standpoint of accuracy, they decided instead of bombing, they were using their plane as a bomb. And, of course, they were going against the big ships. They go to any size, even PT boats. But at any rate, this dawn, we pulled in to wait for our air cover. And before our air cover came, we had pulled in while we killed our engines, and we were still in the cockpit. I had the gunners still in their seats. You had to remain alert all the time. We had 1, 2, 3, 4 boats. Suddenly, while we heard this plane from a distance coming from the east, we heard the engine, and finally we spotted it, and it was a good-sized cove. This plane had watched us, and it was in the sun, and he dropped down over the trees, dropped down on the bay. We saw him just as he dropped down. Well, fortunately for us, he was coming across the bay, and he was already firing. He was right on top of the water, and he was so close to the top of the water, I think he was afraid that he was going to catch his wing in the water and, of course, spin him out. So he had committed himself. Well, what had happened, when he got down on the water, he was already firing his machine guns, but he was just off. His machine guns were going across probably about 20 or 30 feet beyond the bow. He'd misjudged it, and he didn't dare straighten out, but he was missing us, and just barely. All of our gunners were in position, and the 40-millimeter crew, see, the 40-millimeters, they have two seats. It rotates 360 degrees, two seats. One's a pointer, one's a trainer. One of them is horizontal, one is vertical. And those two guys, they've got to zero in to hit the point, hit the target. Well, they were coming around. They shot one shot. They were short. Shot a second shot. They hadn't reached it. The third shot, they hit the suicide straight on and blew it. In the meantime, before that, his machine guns were going across the bow. But they with the third shot, they blew it, and the only thing left floating of the plane was his boot and a map. Well, of course, we started our engines, so we went out and we picked up the map and the boot, and the map showed the airstrip they came from. So we took his boot and the map, of course, took that back to base. That was a suicide plane. That was the most personal one we had, but we had some others, too.
I don't want to be melodramatic, but what would have happened if those guys on that 40-millimeter weren't quite that accurate?
Well, we could have been lucky, because what I thought was, and I was just watching him, if he'd have come back, you know, I think he might have hit his wing, and he might have been short of us. He might have, you know, been able to turn more towards us. I concluded that he just didn't dare. And then, of course, the third shot got him.
But if you guys didn't get him, whether he would have gotten your boat or not, he probably would have hit something. And so you guys probably saved some lives by taking him out, not to mention the, you know, the intelligence value of finding out where they were coming from with that map.
Conceivably, you know, if he could have slanted just a little bit, he would have caught us, at least on the bow, you know. And of course, 3,000 gallons. We're standing on 3,000 gallons of 100 octane under the cockpit.
You might have been in for a little ride there. You might have blown a few hundred feet in the sky, huh?
Yeah, we're standing right on the gas tanks.
So when you told your wife that this was dangerous duty, you weren't lying. And there's another story that illustrates that, because you saw firsthand what could happen to a PT boat and its crew if the enemy hit its target. I do want to warn our listeners, this story could get a little graphic.
Every two squadrons have a one tender ship for supplies and ammunition and everything else for us. So there's 24 boats on one tender ship. They're able to lift PT boats up on either side out of the water so they can repair the props and so on. So on this rainy day, low-hanging clouds, our commanders thought that the planes would not be out. But those Japs, they came in, they surprised us, and they got below the clouds. That was a real commotion. We don't know how many planes they had. We had 24 boats, so we had a lot of firepower. See, all of our guns are anti-aircraft. So that was the worst battle in the biggest battle with aircraft that we had. The PT boats were just really saturating the sky, and we were knocking out planes. And of course, some of the Japs were using bombs on us. I think my boat got probably five planes. Finally, they cleared off. We all started back. We got back to where our tenders were. My boat and another boat pulled up to the tender, and we were going to get some gas and so on. One of the few times we were up on the deck of our tender ship, because we lived on the boats, we noticed them pulling in the 524 boat. We had come over together on the same tanker. They pulled in two boats, and then the one that had been bombed came in third, and one of the other boats was pulling it on the deck. Why, dead bodies on the 524. The skipper was on the wheel, and then the executive officer was next to him, but he was on the deck in the cockpit. Incidentally, that executive officer had been my executive earlier, but he was on the deck. The skipper was standing up by the wheel. All the rest of the boat, the bodies were down. The two bodies on the 40 millimeter in the seats, both of their heads were missing, and their bodies still sitting in their seats. The skipper, he was holding his hand. He had lost all three of his fingers. He had his hands on the wheel. And then the executive, Strawn Taylor, he was laying on the deck, and we thought he was gone. After about an hour, he came to. The rest of the boat, the only two survivors, were Strawn, who was on the floor, and the skipper standing up. The bomb had missed the bow and sprayed the entire length of it and just saturated it. So even the mechanics in the engine room were gone, and then the two bodies. That was the worst sight I'd ever seen.
And I'm sure there had to be part of you that, looking at that ship, and you said how close you were with that ship and that crew, that there had to be part of that that said, hey, that could have been our boat. Sorry, I said ship. I know there's a big difference between a ship and a boat, but that could have been our boat.
Yes, that's true. When you see that, well, you think, well, you know, they were your friends. But that's true. It could have been me.
Well, I'm glad it wasn't, and I know all those kids and grandkids and great-grandkids sure are. Time to catch another break. If you hop on hometownheroesradio.com, you're going to find a link to an interesting article about the origins of the insignia for Motor Torpedo Boat Squadron 36, which Gordon was a part of. You'll find some photos of this 94-year-old Navy vet as well, and you'll hear the rest of his story, including the first person to greet him when he came ashore stateside after the war. It's a name I know you're going to recognize, and that's not the biggest surprise in store for us, because it wasn't the biggest surprise waiting for Gordon. He'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Gordon Caldas, a longtime resident of Grand Forks, North Dakota. In fact, he was the city attorney there, even state's attorney. He's in the University of North Dakota Athletics Hall of Fame. In fact, if you visit the library at his alma mater, you'll find a copy of his World War II memoirs. But you don't have to go all the way to Grand Forks to read that if you don't want to. I have that 57-page document detailing this PT boat commander's experience linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. One image that you'll see if you do that is General Douglas MacArthur wading ashore on the island of Leyte in the Philippines in October of 1944. And Gordon, you were there that day. You saw him head into the beach. But I think you can give us a little more context on MacArthur and on why PT boats had to be part of his return to the Philippines.
That goes back to Pearl Harbor. You see, MacArthur was in charge of all the forces in the Pacific. He was living on Corregidor, which is in the bay of where Manila is. His wife and young son were with him. And there were PT boats in the Philippines at that time. And one of them was Admiral Boat Captain Bulkley, who I got acquainted with after the war. Bulkley took MacArthur and and his wife and son to Australia. And I think there were several boats that made that trip. Bulkley was in charge. He had the family aboard his boat. But, of course, the Japanese knew that he was there. And, of course, Japan is just above the Philippines. But when he left and after he had arrived safely in Australia, he said, "I shall return." That was a famous statement.
And you were there when he fulfilled that promise and waded back ashore on Leyte.
He came in on a battle wagon, but all of our boats were right around the battle wagon and many other boats. Our two squadrons were just laying around in the water there and watching. MacArthur came in on the 524 boat, and so we were right there next to him. And then the 524 drove in towards shore and all lined up on the beach of Leyte Beach were newsreel cameras. There must have been a half a block of them. He got on the PT boat and went in, they drove him in till they got into the shallow water. And then he transferred to a little smaller boat that had a flap on the front. And they took him the rest of the way in. And then he waded ashore. And with all these newsreel cameras, and us observing it, too.
Yeah, what was your vantage point? How close to all of that were you?
We were within 200 or 300 feet. We were right next to it, you know.
Did it feel like a historic moment to you?
Oh, yes. Yes, it did.
When you think back on those days, what is it that you take pride in all these years later? What is it that comes to mind for you that makes you proud?
I know one thing. In PT boats, they're really, they're intimate, you know. You get to know your crew. You got a small crew. There gets to be a real friendship. You've only got two officers out there and then enlisted men. I think that that we and our enlisted men were just about perfect and not in a friendship way that you might imagine. You were really friends. But there's always this difference in, you know, you've got to be the boss. But I was never one, I was never a shouter or yeller or anything like that. Maybe I was kind of shy. I was not pals with my crew, but I felt that they all really liked me, you know, or at least maybe admired me.
Because of the way they treated you with respect, it made you feel like you were doing something right.
Right, right.
I can tell that brings emotions back even today. Were you still over there when the war came to an end?
Yes, I was in Borneo. After Leyte, they sent our two squadrons to Borneo. One of the first things the Japanese took over was Borneo because of the oil wells. And so we were handy. We discovered that all the oil wells were in the interior of Borneo, Dutch Borneo. And so we had to go in rivers and streams and so on to get in there. So that was kind of hairy because, you know, there's no place to run, you know, or even dodge. But anyway, we got in there and the Australian troops were there. The Aussies had sent them there. So then we coordinated with the Australians. You see, the Japanese still had possession of the interior of what we were going to do in our smaller way is to soften up the invasion beach. We set up two squadrons of boats, single file. We'd go back and forth along this east coast of Dutch Borneo. Some of our boats had 5-inch rockets, but we all had 40s and 30s and anti-tank guns and so on. So single file, we went back and forth across that east coast of Dutch Borneo and saturated that jungle. Then the Australians invaded, and as far as I know, they cleaned up the Japanese.
And so that's where you were when you heard Japan had surrendered? How significant a moment was that, and how did you guys react?
Oh, I think it was a big thrill, you know, a big thrill to know that it was over. You know, you were kind of sad for all the Japanese people that were killed, you know, too. You felt sorry for the population, but of course the Japanese were a bitter enemy.
Well, and I guess you had some pretty good reasons to get home. You had to go
See if that wife had waited around for you, huh? What was that reunion like when you got back to the States and saw her again?
I might just say, I was one of the first two officers that were sent back from Dutch Boreal. Uh-huh. I guess two officers came, so I was 522, the first boat. Then Jim Wolf was in the 523. The two of us were the first ones to come back of the officers in our squadrons.
So where was it, and what was it like when you saw Lenore again after all that time overseas? When, honestly, I'm sure there were times where you weren't sure you were coming home.
Well, of course, you know, I was on high, you know, because I was going home and arriving home, and we were the first two officers leaving the squadrons. And, oh, incidentally, we had to hitchhike from Borneo.
It's got to be a little hard to hitchhike from Borneo. There isn't exactly a land bridge there to get you back to the States. How'd you do that?
Well, we found an airport, an Army airport, and you see there's nothing on Dutch Borneo. But anyway, our officers located the nearest airport, and that was in New Guinea. By golly, we got into the tail end of New Guinea, so we got on a plane and got the first leg out. Then we got aboard a troop ship. While we had to ride that troop ship all the way back to Long Beach. Takes a couple of weeks to get back from where we were in Asia.
So after that long, long journey home, you get to Long Beach, you get off the ship, and who tapped you on the shoulder?
Clark Gable.
The Clark Gable.
The Clark Gable, yes. And I recognized his voice right away. But very friendly. He queried me a little bit, you know, what I'd been doing. And this was in front of the Ambassador Hotel. But at any rate, I didn't know that I had a baby.
Talk about burying the lead here. So she had never told you that she was expecting or anything?
Never got a letter all for a year in the South Pacific because we were on the move all the time.
So you never even received a single letter the whole time?
Not a single letter.
So she had written to you saying, hey, we're going to have a baby, but you had no idea. Did you have any, was that ever a thought in your mind, hey, maybe she could be pregnant?
No, no, never, it never occurred to me, yeah.
So you're in for a bit of a surprise here, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah, oh gosh.
So how did you get that news? What was the first you found out?
Well, when I walked in the door, I didn't know about the baby.
And where was this? Where was she?
In Grand Forks.
So you get back to Grand Forks, North Dakota. You think, hey, I'm going to see my beautiful bride again. Open up the door and voila.
Right. But, you know, we were out nowhere. You know, once we hit New Guinea, you know, it was jungle.
And had that caused her some concern, not being able to get in touch with you?
You know, I don't know that it, well, it could have, I don't know. Or she never admitted it, or, you know, or...
What was that reunion like? How did she greet you?
Oh, gosh, I think I hugged her, and probably for 24 hours.
Uh-huh. Well, it couldn't have been all 24 hours, because there's a baby running around somewhere.
I'm just kidding, but... But anyway, it was a good hug. Yeah.
How did you deal with that, the fact that all of a sudden you're a father? You never even knew that was coming.
Well, it was so sudden, you know. I don't know that I really, really could get that excited. Well, I'm sure I was excited, you know. And of course, I loved seeing her and seeing the baby. I couldn't believe that. See, I didn't probably get letters because they're probably lost. Because when we moved, you know, we were never in a place very long, and we lived aboard the boats, so we weren't getting mail. Even our tender ships weren't getting any mail because they were moving, and so we lived on our boats in the open sea.
And I'm sure you're aware that there were a lot of babies whose fathers never came home from World War II. And had that happened to you, you never would have known that there was a baby that didn't have a daddy.
That's true, yeah.
I imagine just thinking about that brings a lot of emotion, not to mention the other four children you'd have and all the grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
when you think back on all that, you think about the kamikazes and the different enemy forces you encountered and all the dangerous situations you were in, do you feel like there was something or someone protecting you along the way?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, I was, you know, I was very fortunate. Yeah. Yeah, you thank God.
And was that something that was a real conscious thing for you at the time, or just something over time you said, yeah, God must have been looking out for me?
Yes. God was looking after me.
Well, I know we've covered a lot of ground here. I want to make sure that I say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story, because no one else could. Is there anything else that you think we need to know about you or the guys you served with?
You really felt like you you knew your crew. You see, you didn't associate with even other PT boat crews because of the circumstances. Once we got dropped in the water in New Guinea, you know, you lived on your boat. And while I was never, you know, palsy-walsy with them, you know, we were always gentlemen to one another, and, you know, I never got angry at my men at all. I admired them because I had such a great crew, so capable and amiable, you know, and I'm sure that probably all, you know, maybe most crews were good. The nature, you know, of it, you were more friends.
It was more shoulder to shoulder than top down?
Right, right, right.
And that seems the how the atmosphere is here at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. What do you like about living here with all these other veterans?
I really enjoy it. I think the environment here is really beautiful. It's literally beautiful, you know. You walk around here and the employees are so nice and helpful and polite and couldn't be better, you know. I think the meals are good. Everything is clean and it's attractive. Flowers, trees, shrubs, well kept. So I really lucked out, I think. We don't have anything like this back home.
Well, we didn't have anything like this here for a long time until some people were really determined, and Charlie Waters has his bust out there for a reason. I know you also have been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. What did you get out of that when you stood there and you saw the different displays and you saw those gold stars representing the 400,000 who never came home from World War II? What did you get out of that whole experience?
I really got a thrill. I really did. Yeah. Well, I got tears in my eyes. Yeah, it's really impressive.
Well, that matches what just about every other veteran who has visited that memorial has said, at least all of those that I've talked to, whether they went with honor flight groups or just on their own. And impressive is a word, I'm sure, that has been used to describe Gordon Caldas a time or two over the years. Thanks again to the Veterans Home of California, where this interview was recorded. It is a very special place that's going to be a blessing to veterans for a long, long time. We're out of time this time on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping to remind you through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.